On your papers, particularly Sheila's just now, is really theoretically very modest. There's no great underpinning. It would be very interesting, another discussion, I think, to debate this question about the difference between first and second generation conscience rights and complicity and so on. I'm actually working on a paper on that just at the moment, but it's not this paper. So you'll have to wait for another time for that. So what I want to do here is to say something fairly modest, but for non-lawyers might be a little bit complex. I want to start from the assumption that conscientious objection somehow needs to be balanced against delivering healthcare. And I want to look at some of the legal avenues for doing that. And in a sense, going back to what Sheila was saying about the Dugan case, what I want to do is to just open up some of the legal roads not taken in that litigation, but which are potentially available in this and in other questions to do with conscience. And there are two parts of what I want to do. The first part is very unpretentious. It's just simply trying to lay out some of the legal background. In the second part, I want to turn more directly conscience in medicine and explain some of the different legal approaches, particularly in rights balancing, that could be taken and what the implications of those are. So then, just to start laying the legal terrain at the beginning, and to give you my sort of map of this, we've really got four routes, I would suggest, by which conscience claims can find their way into legal challenges in general in this, or indeed in other countries as well. And then I try to explain here something about how descriptively they might apply in the UK. So at the constitutional level, so we don't have a written constitution like Ireland, but we do have the Human Rights Act, which has an overriding effect and applies across the range both of common law and statute. And two provisions in particular are important. Section 3, the interpretive obligation requiring courts to read other legislation so far as is possible in a way that conforms to convention, European Convention on Human Rights understandings, including all jurisprudence of the Court of Human Rights. And Section 6, which applies particularly to public authorities, including courts, but health authorities and so on, which requires them not to act unlawfully by infringing a person's convention rights. So there's one kind of constitutional route in for conscience, insofar as conscience is protected under the European Convention. Secondly, we have general equality provisions. I'll come back to the Equality Act 2010 in a minute or two. But these are of application, of course, in the context of employment discrimination, but also there are general duties that apply to public authorities, and the scope of those is quite significant in this context. Thirdly, of course, and we've talked a lot about this already in the workshop, we have specific legislative conscience provisions. Well, we've said already quite a lot about Section 4 of the Abortion Act and Section 38 of the HFEA. And then, as Sarah started opening up for us this morning, we've got professional codes. And for my purpose, what I need to just explain about these, and I'm still thinking through the issues, actually, it'd be interesting to discuss them, is that, of course, the codes that we've got, three of them at least, for the GMC, for the General Pharmacy Council, and for the Nursing and Midwifery Council, have a statutory underpinning to them. And that's significant in two ways, because first of all, it plays into the human rights obligations that I mentioned at the start, because these will be public authorities making those codes, and so subject to the Section 6 duty, as I've mentioned. And also, they will be subject to equality duties, potentially, too. Just moving on slightly, looking at those different kind of ways, then, of framing conscience claims legally, what happens in relation to each of these kinds of sources of law is slightly different So if we're talking about statutory exemptions, such as Section 4 of the Abortion Act, what we're dealing with at one level is simply an exercise in statutory interpretation there. So what does Section 4 cover? What does it not cover? However, as I just explained, because of the application of the Human Rights Act, it can't stop there. This is the route not taken in the Dugan litigation. It's strangely not taken at one point, actually, over the meaning of Section 4 by Baroness Hale, because the court is under a duty to interpret this provision in the light of the Human Rights Act, Section 3, the interpretive obligation. Secondly, we've got legal reasoning in relation to constitutional rights. Now, here, the form of reasoning is slightly different. It's not so much the kind of statutory interpretation type reasoning as you get with specific exemptions. It's more an argument that this law can't stand if there's a conscience claim because it's overbroad. So it has to be read down to a certain extent to allow for conscience. Conscience doesn't take the form of an exemption. It takes a slightly different form. It's the form of saying that the law goes too far, read in the light of what conscience requires. Then we've got a whole body of human rights law and the interpretation of what Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights actually means by the European Court of Human Rights, but as I'll explain later on, not just actually the European Convention. And where the form of reasoning is rather different again to domestic legal reasoning, it's much more perhaps purposive, much more large type reasoning. And then conscience claims feature in relation to codes and regulatory decisions in a rather different way, because here the legal route to invoking conscience is quite distinctive. In principle, it's possible to judicially review the creation of these codes or general regulatory decisions. There are a few examples of that in the case law, not on conscience grounds, but on other grounds. And secondly, of course, where individual regulatory decisions are taken against particular practitioners, then again the conscience route may come in by means of reviewing those individual decisions. Either as a matter of human rights law, or indeed under the scope of the specific statutory exemptions. Just to say a little bit more about equality law, because this is something we've not touched on a great deal. As I just explained in relation to the climate case this morning, a protected characteristic includes not only religion, but also philosophical beliefs under the Equality Act. So many non-religious conscience claims could nonetheless feature as philosophical beliefs in this kind of way within the Equality Act framework. And where we're in that territory, we've got really three things I think that are relevant in this context. First of all, we've got the possibility of a medical practitioner raising a claim of discrimination on grounds of their beliefs, either direct discrimination, i.e. they've been treated less favourably because of their beliefs, or indirect discrimination, that is, the health authority or someone else has adopted a practice which impacts adversely on the group of people of which they're one who hold those beliefs and which cannot be justified by reference to a legitimate aim. Now, of course, there's the snag, because very often there will be a legitimate aim, of course, that one could imagine in such cases. And had Dugan run the full course, no doubt we would have got into exactly that discussion about the proportionate giving effect to legitimate aim in Section 19. But secondly, we've got this general public sector equality duty that will apply both to health authorities and also, interestingly, to regulators. because it has a wider scope under the Equality Act, applying to people exercising, or bodies exercising public functions, and a regulator clearly will be a body exercising a public function for these purposes. And so regulators should, and no doubt have, taken account of the equality duties in formulating their codes, for example, that apply to practitioners. Okay, just to finally complete my sort of part one of my tour, we've got Article 9 then of the European Convention on Human Rights, and it doesn't, on the face of it, refer to a right to conscientiously object. Of course, it refers to a right to freedom of conscience. And it does so in a rather interesting way, because there's something of a mismatch between Article 9.1, which is this provision, and Article 9.2, which I'll come to in just a moment, which potentially raises some questions, because the right under Article 9.1 to one's freedom of thought, or sorry, freedom of religion or belief, includes, you see, the right to manifest religion or belief. But the right to conscience is just the right to freedom of conscience, no reference to manifesting. Now, just taking that as an abstract exercise in thought, as it were, you could go two ways with that, couldn't you? You could either deduce from that formulation that there's no right to manifest one's conscience, that one's conscience is just what's in your head, that you can't follow it through in any particular protective way under Article 9. Or you could, and this would be a sort of rather disruptive reading, you could read it the second way, which is that whereas, as we'll see in a minute, religion or belief is a qualified right, conscience is not. It's an unqualified right. There's a minority judgment in a case called Ouida that I'll come back to that takes that position, that second position. In practice, though, this is in fact irrelevant, because when the Court of Human Rights has tended to interpret how this applies to conscience claims, it's never really sought to treat them separately from religion or belief in any, to any great extent. Oh, let me go back just a minute, actually, if I've got the right button for going back, because I didn't explain the photograph. That's a picture of a group of men I know reasonably well from going back and forth to Yerevan quite a lot a year or so ago on a policy exercise there. The Armenian Army, or the Army of the Republic of Armenia, to give them their proper title. And it was in relation to them and the failure to provide in Armenian law for a right of conscientious objection that the European Court of Human Rights, in a case called Bayatayan, established for the first time that Article 9 includes the right to conscientiously object. So a decision of some importance by the Grand Chamber of the Court. Now, as I said, there's a second limb to Article 9, which is the qualification part of it. And potentially, of course, qualifications related to health and to the rights and freedoms of others that are particularly important in our context. And where those apply, they invite a balancing process. The person shown in the bottom right-hand part of the slide, the famous marriage registrar, Lillian Liddell, who challenged under Article 9 as one of a group of claimants from the UK, her failure in UK discrimination law to achieve a remedy because her employer required her to undertake same-sex civil partnership ceremonies. And she lost out under this balancing process. The court found that the balancing against the rights and freedoms of others was engaged, but it was legitimate for the UK and for her employer to require her to do this particular kind of work. So again, you can start to see the possible analogies with how our conscience claims might play out under Article 9 raised by medical practitioners. Okay, now that gets rid of the first part, rather modest kind of descriptive part of my presentation. Let's turn to the more interesting part, which is how then we can differentiate different forms of reconciling between these various rights claims, particularly in human rights. And I want to distinguish, as you see, between two kinds of rights balancing, what we can call definitional rights balancing and what we can call ad hoc or proportional rights balancing. And what I understand by definitional balancing is this, when we look at, for example, what does freedom of conscience involve, what's the extent of that, we're engaging in an exercise of actually determining the boundary between that right and other rights. And if we say, well, this is actually quite a good way to go, it's good to balance rights in this definitional way, we could argue that, well, actually, this is rather clear. So it allows us to establish in advance some boundaries so everyone knows where they stand. So if you're a medical professional, you know that you can't claim conscience in relation to these kinds of activities. They're only so far. A definitional approach kind of helps in doing that. On the downside, though, a definitional approach unfortunately kind of flattens. So it imposes a uniform type solution in relation to conscience claims in different contexts, potentially, and is rather inflexible. It doesn't allow us to actually take account of the particularities of, say, an individual midwife, a labour ward, or whatever. So we just have a uniform solution that we're going to apply to it. As against that, the other form of rights balancing I describe as proportional or ad hoc balancing. So this is quite different. It recognises that freedom of conscience may overlap in places with other rights. And where the overlap occurs, a court is engaged in a process of contextually adjusting, looking at the specific context in which the overlap has to be applied and weighing the application of the rights in that context. So it sounds a lot more kind of fine-tuned in a way, but again, it has a downside, which is that if we want to actually use this predictively, it's rather unsatisfactory, because until we get to a particular context or situation, we don't know how the balance is going to fall out. And in terms of who does the decision-making, actually, this kind of balancing between rights puts a great onus on judicial discretion in deciding how this particular situation is different to that. So it puts the balance of power in the hands of the judges while creating uncertainty for litigants to some extent. But applying that distinction between definitional and proportional balancing between conscience and other rights, how does this play out? Well, in terms of domestic law, and we've already had up several times on the screen section 4, you can see, can't you, looking at the text of section 4 of the Abortion Act, how there's potential there for engaging in this kind of definitional balancing approach. So, and again, many of us will be familiar with how this works in the Dugan case. So the case, Baroness Hale's judgment, discusses two definitional terms, doesn't it? What is in the course of treatment and what is participating in treatment? And those are both treated as an exercise in definition, in statutory interpretation. But there are other definitional elements potentially as well, which could feature under section 4.2 in terms of setting the boundaries for freedom of conscience against other claims. Well, I've already kind of alluded to this. We can see in domestic law that the cases on section 4 really engage in this kind of exercise. So who's entitled to make the claim? Well, only someone who's a participant in an abortion in a course of treatment under the Act. So a secretary typing the letter in January is not a participant. That's a definitional exclusion. A supervising midwife is not a participant. Again, a definitional exclusion in my terms. We see the same thing going on under European convention law as well. Here we're getting nearer the point, I think. So in this well-known but quite old decision concerning pharmacists in France, Pichon and Sajou, do people know about this case? Some not, I guess. It's a criminal conviction of French pharmacists, three of them, who have an objection to prescribing the morning after pill for religious reasons. And that's actually a criminal offence not to prescribe. And they challenged their criminal conviction at the European Court of Human Rights. And they failed on the grounds that, well, as we heard in discussion sometimes this morning, you have a right to your conscience, of course, but you don't have a right to be a pharmacist. So you have to adjust. You have to adjust your conscience if you're practicing as a pharmacist, as the court says. As long as the sale of contraceptives is legal and occurs on medical prescription nowhere other than the pharmacy, the applicants cannot give precedence to their religious beliefs and impose them as justification for their refusal to sell such products, since they can manifest those beliefs in many ways outside the professional sphere. So that's a definitional approach in the way that I've been talking about it. You may not be so familiar with this second case concerning the dismissal from Germany, Rummelfanger, concerning the dismissal of a doctor from a Catholic hospital, a dissenting doctor. But again, he's found not to have a right to freedom of expression because he has the option of resigning, rather similar to the Pichon and Sajou case. So when he's working in a Catholic hospital, his right to freedom of expression is to be taken to be more limited in that context. Now, that kind of definitional balancing approach used to be the norm in relation to the right of freedom of conscience under Article 9, but times have changed. And they changed in an employment context, in this group of cases I mentioned earlier on, from the UK called Ouida. Previously, it would have been the practice of the Court of Human Rights to say, if you're employed, your right of freedom of conscience is protected by your right to resign. From Ouida onwards, although three of these litigants lose, because they lose under Article 9.2, there's a quite different approach, though, which is to say they do have a right, and it does have to be balanced in their employment. So this, they lose because they lose under 9.2, not under 9.1. They don't lose definitionally. They lose as a result of the proportional balancing process. None of them, by the way, were medical practitioners. But you can see that same kind of approach being flagged up in relation to abortion by the court in this case of R in Poland, a balancing approach. This didn't, by the way, involve directly a conscientious objection. It was the claim involved slightly different. I better not go into it because it takes too long. But anyway, just take it from me. It didn't directly involve a conscientious objection claim. But nonetheless, here the court says that states are obliged to organise health services in such a way to ensure effective exercise of freedom of conscience does not prevent patients from obtaining access to services they're entitled to. So in other words, there's an obligation to balance. It's not that conscience is irrelevant, but it does have to be balanced against healthcare. Now, here's something we've not come across before. So the European Charter of Social Rights contains a right to the best healthcare available under Article 11, And there have been a series of cases in which the committee on social rights has considered the availability of abortion, notably in Italy, but challenges are also being raised in relation to Sweden as well. But here too, you can see from the quotation that I've got from one of these Italian cases, the context in Italy being, of course, that 70 to 80% of practitioners object to participating in abortion on conscientious grounds, and that affects the general availability of abortion. That was the context for these challenges. The Committee on Social Rights has said this, that once states introduce statutory provisions allowing abortion in some situations, they're obliged to organise their health system in such a way, again, so that we get the balancing. It's the same wording as in the RR case, or very, very similar wording to it. Which brings me finally, well, no, that doesn't, not quite finally, nearly finally. So and you get the same formulation as well from another Council of Europe body, the Parliamentary Committee of the Council of Europe in its resolution on the conscientious objection in lawful medical healthcare, which again refers to this kind of balancing process that has to go on. Just let me explain about the legal status of these things, by the way. That's a resolution that could be used as a kind of soft law basis in interpreting rights in the future. It doesn't have any other effect in its own right. The European Social Committee decision that I referred to earlier on is not directly applicable in English law in the same way that the Convention on Human Rights is. It has a slightly have a different status, so they're not all of a piece. But they're all going in the same direction in terms of this balancing approach rather than a definitional approach. Yes, and then finally, we've got this potentially upcoming case from Sweden in which a midwife, Eleanor Grimmark, who was denied right at three clinics in Sweden, because of her stance on abortion, she took a challenge to the Swedish courts, was unsuccessful in that challenge. It was found not to be discriminatory against her. Although I think I'm right to say that the Court of Appeal, did actually reason this through the balancing process in the way that I've described, but found that it was permissible to outweigh her religious objections to participating in abortion. She has lodged an application with the European Human Rights Court, and assuming it's accepted, and it hasn't yet been, I checked yesterday with the body supporting her, assuming it's accepted, it will play directly into these issues of balancing under 9.2 in precisely the way that was not reached by the Supreme Court in Dugan, in fact. So it will be impossible, I think, for the European Court of Human Rights, if it accepts this case, to determine it otherwise than by going through the balancing process under Article 9.2, and the outcome will be very, very interesting. Sweden, if we had a kind of spectrum of countries, Sweden is an outlier because it's perhaps the only Council of Europe country, or certainly one of very few Council of Europe countries, that does not recognise a right of conscientious objection for medical practitioners to abortion.
One of three.
Okay, thank you. It's Iceland and
Finland.
Finland. Okay, yeah. So very much on one end of the spectrum, if we took Council of Europe state. And that will be quite significant, potentially, if the court comes to tackle this under Article 9.2, because of the so-called margin of appreciation doctrine. There could well be an argument that Sweden is outside it, or have a very narrow margin because of where it sits in the whole spectrum of European countries. So just to conclude then, UK law so far, as I said, has favoured a definitional approach to handling conscientious objection claims. That would have been true in the Council of Europe as well, but the sands are shifting particularly shifting since 2013. And just to look ahead, as this kind of proportional balancing comes to assume greater prominence, it could well have a deep stabilising effect for understandings of the exemptions we've got, but also potentially for professional codes.